And indeed it is 5:30. It's time for Rockin' the Boat. My name is the V-Man. My guest today is Rahul Mahajan. We're going to be discussing the Bush administration's outright lies to lead this country into war with Iraq. Stand by, stay tuned. That's all coming up in just one moment. Rockin' the Boat, 5:30 to 6 each weekday, Monday through Friday, 96.3 FM. Freak Radio. Over the past year, the Bush administration has made specific and unequivocal statements about the imminent threat posed by Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction, repeatedly claiming they had intelligence showing Iraq had 25,000 liters of anthrax, 38,000 liters of botulinum toxin, 500 tons of sarin mustard and VX nerve gas, and over 30,000 munitions capable of delivering chemical agents. So where are those vast stockpiles? Where was the imminent threat? At the State of the Union address, the president said, quote, Hussein had the materials to produce as much as 500 tons of sarin, mustard, and VX nerve agent. Where are those vast stockpiles? Where was the imminent threat? This administration repeatedly claimed Iraq's weapons of mass destruction represented an imminent threat to this country. They claimed specific evidence of vast stockpiles. Where are the vast stockpiles? Where was the imminent threat? Did this administration deliberately mislead this nation into war, telling us that there was an imminent threat when there was not? Those are the words of Ohio Congressman and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich, who spoke them on the House floor June 11th, 2003. Well, today on Rockin' the Boat, we'll look into this very issue. Joining me right now via telephone from the Z Media Institute is longtime community activist Rahul Mahajan. He is a founding member of the No War Collective and serves on the national boards of Peace Action and the National Network to End the War Against Iraq. His first book, The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism, has been described as mandatory reading for anyone who wants to get a handle on the war on terrorism. His latest book, Full Spectrum Dominance, The U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, is hot off the presses and available through independent bookstores. Rahul Mahajan writes frequently for mainstream and alternative media in print and on the World Wide Web. He is a co-author of End the Deception, which ran in the June 4th, 2003 edition of USA Today newspaper. Rahul, thanks for joining me here on Rockin' the Boat.
Thanks for having me.
I'll ask you the question posed on the House floor. In a word, did this administration deliberately mislead the nation into war, telling us that there was imminent threat when there was not?
That's absolutely the case, but let us distinguish between several different things. First of all, were the claims of a possible massive Iraqi stockpiles. Second was the claim that Iraq posed an imminent threat. And third is the question of whether, even if either of these two things were true, if both of these things were true, the administration still could have lied. So one thing that's clear is whether or not they find any weapons, there was no imminent threat. Another thing that's clear is that the administration lied repeatedly. Even if they find weapons, that is not going to change the fact that the administration lied repeatedly.
In your editorial in the USA Today, you raise some important questions that citizens in a true democracy really should be asking. You write, quote, the problem isn't simply that no evidence of banned weapons programs has been found, but a broader pattern of deception, end quote. You raise three issues in the editorial, and I'd like to look maybe at each one individually. Before the war, there were statements made by Bush to the effect that Iraq had tried to purchase weapons-grade uranium from Niger. What evidence are these claims by the president based on?
Well, it's interesting. These claims are based on an incredibly crude forgery. In fact, the forgery is so crude that literally if you got a couple of eighth graders together, have them do a few Google searches, they could have figured out in a few hours that the documents were forged. So, for example, the name of the foreign minister of Niger on one of the documents was the name of who had been foreign minister 10 years ago. It made reference to an outdated constitution, and there were several other similar signs that you could tell very easily that the signature was forged. I mean, it was a phenomenally fraudulent document. In fact, among the CIA, among agents who repeatedly did mention that this was not credible, and yet somehow the document was used repeatedly in presentation by high administration officials, including by George W. Bush.
This was a CIA document then, originally? That's where it originated?
No. The claim is now that it was forged by some African identity, undisclosed as far as I know.
Undisclosed.
And simply found its way in through British intelligence to American intelligence. And again, it went through all these various layers to the top, where at any stage it was really obvious that it was a forgery.
Then the second point in your editorial you raise is Secretary of State Colin Powell's UN presentation. Extensive evidence was put forth with a slideshow, other exhibits. Were any of his claims true?
Well, none of those claims have panned out yet, and some of them were simply ludicrous. So he claims that there is a threat from Iraq's unmanned aerial vehicles, which could potentially deliver chemical or biological weapons by spraying. He shows us a picture. The picture is an artist's rendition of what such a drone unmanned vehicle would look like, and an artist's picture posing as evidence. And then when we finally did see, when the Iraqis finally showed these unmanned aerial vehicles, they looked literally like the Wright Brothers glider at Kitty Hawk. I mean, if you simply looked at them, they're these small, flimsy wooden constructions, and it was clear they had no payload capacity whatsoever. And that's just one piece of many. I mean, you mentioned we listed 3 points in the USA Today article. That's because we were given 400 words. If the more words we were given, the more different points we could have laid out.
Well, let's talk a little bit about recently. It was disclosed, in fact, speaking of Colin Powell's presentation, that one of the things that he put forth was turned out to be a fire engine. And he made the claim that this was a biological weapons lab that was traveling on wheels or some sort of thing like that. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more of what you think about this pattern and what it means for us. I mean,
there's a systematic, I mean, when you do intelligence work, you gather all kinds of claims. Many of them are fraudulent. It's a standard known thing in intelligence work. So therefore, in order to get something that where you can feel confident about stating a claim, you have to have multiple sources. You have to have some standards on the credibility of the sources. There are internal consistency checks, like, for example, what I mentioned with the document from Niger. If you get the name of government officials wrong, that's a pretty severe internal consistency problem. And what happened was a systematic pattern of relaxing all of these controls, of simply taking whatever came in, and, you know, potentially, who knows, maybe they didn't even have to generate any such documents. They could simply find those generated by others or random claims by defectors, and defectors' claims are notoriously unreliable, and simply take all of them, these wild, speculative, completely unsubstantiated claims, and claim them as absolute fact. And there is obviously not just deception, but an outright lie to take something that is highly speculative and claim it as a fact. And Dick Cheney even said, in a speech in, I believe, in January, he said openly that Iraq has a nuclear weapons program. You know, these kinds of things they're very blatant lies, and they show several things. I mean, one of the things they show is that they were not even trying very hard to create some kind of case for the war in Iraq. They show a blatant disrespect for democracy. So for a six month build up to war, they tell us always that it's about weapons of mass destruction, it's about an imminent threat. And again, I want to distinguish, the existence of weapons of mass destruction does not prove an imminent threat any more than, say, the fact that the United States has a massive nuclear arsenal proves that it is an imminent threat to attack any other country. If Iraq had any weapons of mass destruction, it still made absolutely no signs of aggression, manifested no signs of aggressive intent toward the United States, and in fact never has in its history. There's never been any serious attack on the United States that we have evidence was even contemplated by Iraq. So we're sold on the war because of weapons of mass destruction, because of an imminent threat, and suddenly that disappears, and we're told, well, the war was good because they liberated the Iraqi people. Now, independent of that claim, I mean, we can just dissect that claim, and the claim that this is liberation is really laughable, but independent of that claim, the fact that they have completely abandoned that previous argument which they use to make the case shows a real contempt for public opinion and for any kind of democratic process based on informed consent.
And we saw that right at the beginning of the war with the name of the Operation Iraqi Freedom. I mean, that said it right there. I mean, this was originally about weapons of mass destruction and imminent threat, and then suddenly it's about liberating the Iraqis. I mean, well, can you talk maybe a little bit about what the comments of Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, who has been somewhat candid as of late in a lot of articles in the mainstream and Vanity Fair, he again backed away from these claims. What more can you tell us about where he stands in all of this?
Okay, well, I think we have to be very careful about what the actual claims he made were. So he said, for example, that for bureaucratic reasons, that they settled on weapons of mass destruction as the primary issue. This has been seized on by some people to say that he actually admitted that weapons of mass destruction were simply a manufactured issue. Now, they were a manufactured issue, and he was part of manufacturing them, but this was not an admission. I wouldn't expect Paul Wolfowitz to just come out without any prompting and admit to this pattern of deception. What he was really saying was there were many reasons. There was an internal debate. The neoconservatives wanted to start. They actually wanted to lead. Richard Perle, for example, said from the beginning, we should say it's about liberating Iraq and not about weapons of mass destruction. There were disagreements between defense and state, among various other agencies, and for bureaucratic reasons, they picked the one weapons of mass destruction that everyone could agree on as the political choice. Now, this is a deceptive process, but it's not quite the same as saying they just manufactured the issue, although, of course, they did.
I'm speaking today with Rahul Mahajan. He is a founding member of the No War Collective, serves on the National Boards of Peace Action and the National Network to End the War Against Iraq, and his first book is called The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism, and he has a new book coming out, or just out now, in fact, called Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Rahul, a lot of these claims started with a man named Ahmed Chalabi, and he has been widely publicized in the mainstream press. He insists that Saddam Hussein's missing weapons of mass destruction do indeed exist. He has been accused of false intelligence, but has said, quote, the weapons are there. What about this man? What can you tell us about Chalabi and his claims? And
Chalabi is also claiming that Saddam Hussein is alive and actively directing the Ba'ath Party-based opposition to the American occupation. And while there is some reason to believe there is some Ba'athist opposition, I can't imagine that there is any overt evidence that Saddam Hussein is directing it. The man has a history and a reputation for dishonesty. So, for example, he's wanted by the Jordanian government for bank fraud, for embezzlement, a charge dating back many years. He's been a Washington lobbyist and hanger-on, always trying to lobby the United States to go in and make war on Iraq. I mean, there's nothing particularly credible about any claims he makes, and he is an exile with no popular base in Iraq, so one wonders exactly what kind of organization he has to even claim to have sources for this relative non-public domain private information.
Rahul, we have about 10 minutes left, and I guess I kind of want to get your thoughts then on where this goes. I mean, today, in fact, the United Nations Security Council granted even more, basically they granted immunity to the United States from prosecution in the International Criminal Court. Three countries obviously abstaining from the vote, but the footing that the United States has now with the occupation of Iraq fully underway and this issue of weapons of mass destruction, do you think it will go anywhere? I mean, I'm reading in an article right now by Rob Elder. It was published in the Mercury News yesterday, an opinion piece, and it kind of compares this whole affair to the Lewinsky affair with President Bill Clinton. Do you think that this is enough to maybe push an impeachment of George W. Bush?
No, because the general rule in American domestic politics is, in a sense, the less truly important the affair, the more likely someone is to be impeached for it. So Richard Nixon was not impeached for the so-called secret bombing of Cambodia. He was not impeached for the massive escalation of bombing of North Vietnam. He was not impeached for COINTELPRO operations, which were targeted popular movements, everything from the Socialist Workers Party to the Black Panther Party for essentially the extrajudicial assassination of Fred Hampton, a Black Panther organizer in Chicago. He was instead impeached for what was described as a third-rate burglary because it was a burglary of the Democratic Party offices, and so it targeted another faction of the elite. The Lewinsky affair, obviously, while it did show systematic abuse of the president's power in a personal realm, was not also an affair on the scale of the bombing of a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan or the illegal Desert Fox bombing of Iraq in December of 1998, both of which would have been much more plausible things to impeach Clinton for.
Again, I'm speaking with Rahul Mahajan. He is the author of the book Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. The war, you mentioned that Chalabi has made this claim that Saddam is directing attacks against U.S. forces occupying Iraq. In fact, since the war has been declared, quote, over, there have been over 30 troops been killed since May 1st. 85 attacks alone in the month of May against U.S. forces. And today, two aircraft were downed, as we're hearing from the BBC. What about that? I mean, it doesn't seem like the people in Iraq are taking to this occupation. The war's not over. What can we do here to get the United States out of that country?
Well, it's fascinating that the claim still is that the United States is bringing democracy to Iraq. And if you look, on the one hand, there is the armed resistance to the U.S. occupation. On the other hand, there are mass peaceful demonstrations, many of which have been broken up by U.S. Army violence. In total, over 50 peaceful demonstrators have been killed by the U.S. military, which is a phenomenal toll. I mean, it's not common that you have the troops simply opening fire on peaceful demonstrators. So somehow the Iraqi people don't want this liberation. The people's will seems to be against our imposition of democracy. Some people claim that this is because somehow Iraqis don't understand or want the concept of democracy, or it's not appropriate to them. And so the big debate now is not over whether the United States wants to bring democracy to Iraq, but whether the Iraqis are democratizable. But in fact, I think what it means is that the Iraqis are against this sham process of democracy where a heavy-handed military occupation is tied in with the passage through the UN of a resolution which was called the ending the sanctions, but which was really transferring control of Iraq's oil wealth to the United States occupying authority, which is tied in with an absolutely sham process of democracy, which has now become so egregious, this process of bringing together political groupings to so-called create democracy, that the latest U.S. proposal for how to create this so-called democracy, all the U.S. hand-picked Iraqi opposition groups have united in signing a letter of protest against, because the process is to pick 25 to 30 Iraqi political figures picked by the U.S. occupying forces, who will then convene a, quote, constitutional convention in which they will handpick the delegates themselves. The Constitution is to be written by an American law professor and simply ratified by these handpicked people. This is such a sham. This is such a violation of the idea of genuine popular consultation, local elections to create delegates to a real constitutional convention where the Iraqi people and their representatives work out through political dialogue what kind of constitution they would have. The Iraqi people certainly don't want this, the U.S.-controlled sham of democracy. That does not mean that they don't want real democracy.
And I just read a report, in fact, today that the oil has started to flow again and the stocks are rising. Can you comment maybe on who got the contract? Chevron Texaco is one of the companies that I saw in the brief headline I read. What are your thoughts right now as the U.S. seizes control of the oil?
So under sanctions, the U.S. oil companies could not buy Iraqi oil directly. They bought it indirectly or through third parties. It was a little bit more complicated. Right now, when the oil has started flowing again, U.S. companies are buying it directly. But these contracts are not the big ones to be worried about. There are plans afoot, very serious plans, to privatize Iraqi's oil, which is to say to denationalize it, to take it from right now where it's the property of the Iraqi people and make it instead the property of foreign corporations, including ExxonMobil and Chevron Texaco. These are contracts worth over the long term, trillions of dollars to these companies, and that's dollars that will be taken away from the Iraqi people, taken away from their basic needs. Those are the big things to look for, but they're not really going to happen until some sham democratic process is formed and the U.S. can claim that it's the Iraqis who are deciding to do it instead of the United States.
And it seems like these oil companies and others are not going to let, you know, human rights and people's lives get in their way to stop them. Maybe in our final moments together, Rahul, I could have you comment on, we're seeing a lot of stories in the paper lately about Iran and possibility that they have a nuclear weapons program and that they have ties to Al-Qaeda, terrorism, and the like. And the sort of same kind of thing is playing out. Where do you think this is going, and what sort of prospects do you see to resist?
Well, we must say that the U.S. military occupation of Iraq, which they plan to make at least at some level a permanent or semi-permanent occupation, is of tremendous significance for U.S. dominance of the region. It gives it vastly greater political leverage, and in fact, in this new situation, the Israeli ambassador to the United States has already stated openly, in fact, more than a month ago, that the United States can bring about regime change in Syria through a combination of economic sanctions, diplomatic isolation, and what he delicately called psychological pressure, which essentially means use of the military presence there as a threat, perhaps amounting up to and including military strikes in Iran, perhaps limited military strikes on the reactors in question, but constant saber-rattling to increase the pressure. So there is real potential, especially now since Iran is surrounded on all sides except for a short border with Russia by American troops. American troops are in all of the other neighbors of Iran. There is real potential for attempts at regime change, even short of war, and it's something very much to watch out for. What we can do about it, I think we should understand something. On February 15th, you know, over 10 million people around the world in 900 cities gathered together to say with one voice, no to the war. The reason was that those people around the world understood that the war in Iraq had tremendous geopolitical significance, not just significance to Iraqis and Americans, but to everyone, because a dramatic increase of U.S. power is harmful, of the U.S. government power is harmful to everyone, including to the average American. Right now, the situation is similar. U.S. control of Iraq, if the United States can create a government of Iraq that obeys its dictates, is similar, of a similar geopolitical importance. If we can intervene in any way, which is to say if the people can mobilize to allow Iraqi democracy to come up instead of a U.S.-controlled government formation, this is powerfully important. And in this struggle, we would have the alliance of the Iraqi people, who are not really politically active in the anti-war movement. They had no leverage, but right now are very much against U.S. occupation. There are very exciting possibilities to build links, solidarity links like are being done in Palestine, have people go over there and be democracy observers, have an occupation watch, which is what Global Exchange is doing. We can work together with the forces, popular resistance forces on the ground in Iraq, democratic forces, to actually pressure the United States to allow democracy to emerge in Iraq.
And that's the voice of Rahul Mahajan. He's a founding member of the No War Collective, serves on the national boards of Peace Action and the National Network to End the War Against Iraq. And his latest book, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, is hot off the presses and available at your local independent bookstore. Rahul, thanks for joining me. Maybe you could give us some a website of your organization, the No War Collective, and where people can read some of your insightful opinions and editorials.
Yeah, a couple of websites. First of all, the No War Collective is www.nowarcollective, all one word, .com. My own website, which contains all of my articles to date, is www.rahulmahajan, RahulMahajan.com.
All right, great. I really appreciate your time today, and thanks for joining me here on Rockin' the Boat.
Thanks.
And we'll be in touch again soon.
Great.
Bye-bye. And indeed, you're tuned in to Rockin' the Boat here at 96.3 FM Free Radio Santa Cruz. My name is V-Man, and my guest today was Rahul Mahajan. He is a founding member of the No War Collective, serves on the National Boards of Peace Action and the National Network to End the War Against Iraq. Tune in again tomorrow. My guest will be local satirist, social satirist,
Don Munkerud, his exhibit of photos from some of those very same demonstrations we were just talking about are up right now, being shown in an exhibit at the Loudon Nelson Center for the month of June. He'll be my guest live in the studio tomorrow from 5:30 to 6 here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
When the United States was born some 200 years ago, it was dedicated to a bold new concept of pushing people around, of setting back the cause of life, liberty, and the individual's pursuit of happiness.
This kind of thinking is what causes the young to rebel. An example is this, written across a poster at a local theater in Philadelphia.
A-W-O-L, period. A-W-O-L, period. A-W-O-L, period.
Magazine.
A-W-O-L, period.
Sacred list of demands. Who among us can give translation of autumn hues to morning news? The anchor man thrown overboard has simply rooted us in history's repeating cycle. A nation in its sad years that won't acknowledge karma. Where is that voice from nowhere? The ones your prophets spoke of. There are voices from fear, disconnected from their diaphragms, dangling from coffee-covered teeth that spill into our laps and scorch our privates. There are voices from the sides of necks, some already noosed, dangling participles, pronouns running for sentence, serving life in corner offices and ghetto corners. Their voices are the same, dead to themselves, numb to the possibility of truth existing beyond that which they can palm in their hands, period. There are voices of elders, which seem to do no more than damn us to our childish ways. For in many households, wisdom no longer comes with age. So where is that voice from nowhere? That burning bush, that passing dove? I hear the voices of generals calling for ammunition, presidents calling for arms, women calling for help. Where is that voice from nowhere? That God of Abraham, can he be heard over the gunfire? The whiz of passing missiles, the crash of buildings, the cries of children, the crack of bones, the shriek of sirens? Or is that his mighty voice? Your angry God craving the sacrifice of virgin generation sons degenerate. Your holy books written in red ink on burning sands. Your prayers between rounds do no more than fasten the...